Case number 23358, Michael Grassi et al. Versus John Grassi et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Giorgiani, you may proceed for the appellants.
And good afternoon, counsel. I do want to advise you that Judge Batchelder is present today, but she is participating by audio only. And I do want to assure you that we are prepared for your cases and that we've read your briefs. Because we're prepared, we would prefer to please argue the most critical issues in your case. We will assume that arguments that are not made today, that you rely upon the arguments contained in your briefs. All right, you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Judge Griffin, and may it please the court. The first of our summary judgment arguments concerns our claims for quantum merit and unjust enrichment. Rule 56 says that it's the burden of the movant to show that there's no genuine dispute as to any material fact. And the issue in this case on summary judgment on those claims was whether Michael was fairly compensated or John unjustly enriched for Michael's work performed before 2012. Now, John persuaded the district court by citing post-2012 payments, which included W-2 payments, after Michael began working full-time at Alitech. Now, as to the unjust enrichment claim, the first thing to note is how much defendants want to focus on the quantum merit claim, because the unjust enrichment facts are rather bleak for the defendants. Here we have an arm's length third-party contract valuing this technology, and that is a reliable measure of enrichment. Now, defendants' brief argues, quote, successful companies often profit on contributions made by their employees and contractors. That's true enough, but this case is far from the routine case in that regard. This case is distinguishable in that there was no contract, no written contract, and no contract other than just the twins' verbal agreement. There is a genuine issue of material fact regarding the amounts of money paid to Michael prior to 2012. And whatever that amount is, whatever this court's able to glean from the summary judgment record, it's a paltry amount compared to the eight figures that the Honda contract represents. As to the quantum merit claim, John did not prove on summary judgment how much money he paid to Michael for his pre-2012 work and ingenuity. There are multiple instances that I could point to. I'll point to one in particular. The affidavit of Alitech's CFO, Ms. Preston, is cited in defendant's brief. And all that shows is that prior to 2013, Alitech paid Michael and CFOM only $58,000. Even if the court construes all the evidence in favor of John on summary judgment, which is the opposite of what we're supposed to do, the evidence shows that Michael received nothing pre-2009 and only $164,000 pre-2012. And of course, of that amount, Michael's testimony at deposition was that most was for just reimbursement of expenses. Despite all of this, the district court on summary judgment decided that whatever amount Michael received, that was enough, and the jury would not receive those claims.
Let me ask a question about the basis of this, the unjust enrichment in quantum merit. Is that based on intellectual property? Is that based on the intellectual property and trade secrets?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I mean, I don't know if it's fair to just limit the categorization that way. It was certainly for his work, right? His time. One could measure the value of his service that way. But
I'm just struggling with the fact that I thought under Ohio law, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act is the sole remedy for non-contractual misappropriation of trade secrets, and it actually displaces unjust enrichment claims. Is that an accurate statement of the law?
Your Honor, I have no idea. That has been raised. I've not seen it raised in this case in the record anywhere. But this is not really a as to the quantum merit and unjust enrichment, I don't think it's fair to characterize that as the gist of it is not misappropriation. The gist of it is, I did this work. I conveyed this value, right? Not just in out measured by hours, but in terms of engineering ingenuity. Mm-hmm. And so that work has value. And one can measure that under quantum merit, you know, by hours and ingenuity.
By the detriment to the plaintiff, how can you articulate exactly what the detriment to the plaintiff was here, and where that's alleged in the complaint?
Well, it's inherent in the quantum Merowit claim, right? That is the nature of quantum Merowit is I did this work, and it is unjust that I did not receive any compensation for it. That's just the nature of quantum Merowit. Unjust enrichment, on the other hand, the damage is being measured by the amount by which the defendant was enriched.
Yes, thank you,
Your Honor. The jury should have received the quantum merit and unjust enrichment claims, all the more so because the jury found that there was no express contract. The jury, in essence, was saying, we would decide this case based on quantum merit, unjust enrichment. But those claims did not reach the jury because of the erroneous summary judgment. The second set of claims that were decided on summary judgment concerned ownership of the intellectual property. And the trial court's decision turned on an exception to the general rule that we construe evidence in favor of the non-moving party. And that exception was that when it comes to affidavits claiming that a signature on some document was a forgery, there has to be corroborating evidence. But that rule is applied in situations where a defendant is trying to stave off some, or a plaintiff trying to stave off summary judgment with a naked claim of that's not my signature. And that's not what happened here. Most significant fact in this case is that Michael, claiming ownership of this intellectual property, initiated this litigation, and that alone is a circumstance that distinguishes this case from all the others. And I'll pause a moment and elaborate on the meeting between Alitech's IP lawyer, Mr. Moldovani, and the twins. And the district court and the defendants still now rely on that meeting, Michael's silence during that meeting and after that meeting, as evidence that he was disclaiming any ownership to this property. And the reason that that meeting is significant is that it plays into one of the themes of our case, which is the twins had a joint venture and they were presenting themselves to Honda as a unified front. I think that was a term that Michael used. This was one, they were presenting themselves as one entity. And so when they were meeting with Mr. Moldovani for the purposes of negotiating the Honda contract, what they were doing was defining their intellectual property to be distinguished from Honda's future intellectual property, because the work that Alitech and Michael and John were going to do under the contract would create intellectual property that would be Honda's. So they were carving out and identifying, calling out their own intellectual property. And the purpose of that meeting was to specify all of the brothers' intellectual property as being separate from Honda, not as the intellectual property being separate as between the two of them. Moving on to our trial errors, Plaintiff's Exhibit 8 was excluded at trial, and that is the exhibit that consisted of four emails that came less than 4 months after the purported work product agreements that my client supposedly signed. And in this exhibit, John himself is offering the same document and proposing it as a new agreement. And in that exhibit, Alitech's lawyer is acknowledging Michael's continued intellectual property rights. Now, that document should have been admissible under Evidence Rule 404B2 to prove John's motive, intent, and plan to avoid his promise to pay Michael. In other words, this exhibit was inadmissible to prove ownership of intellectual property, because the trial court had already decided intellectual property ownership on summary judgment, but it was admissible to prove breach of contract, the claims in front of the jury. And the exclusion of this exhibit was far from harmless. There is a substantial risk that the outcome of this trial would have been different if the jury believed that John had forged Michael's signatures, because why else would John have done that other than to avoid paying Michael. Now, Rule 404B2 was never cited in the district court, but there's a very good reason for that. The district court excluded this exhibit on the ground of attorney-client privilege, which of course precluded the applicability of any other rule of evidence. The trial court later said that was error, but harmless error. And for the reasons that I just described, it's not. I'm going to skip over the law of the case doctrine, but of course I'll be happy to answer any questions about that. My final word here, my presentation in chief, concerns the promissory estoppel claim. At trial, the district court erroneously instructed the jury on the burden of proof, instructing that the plaintiff's burden of proof was clear and convincing evidence. My historical research into this issue is accurate, and the defendants do not argue otherwise. My conclusion is supported by the Ohio Judicial Conference. The defendant's effective response is, more of Ohio courts have reached the wrong answer, or at least articulated the wrong, they haven't really analyzed it, they've articulated the wrong answer. Therefore, the federal courts need to follow the wrong answer. And in fact, this court's obligation, federal court's obligation, is to predict what the Supreme Court of Ohio would do. And in this, as to this issue, not only the Supreme Court of Ohio, but any court that looked at the history of all these cases would reach the conclusion that I did. And that is why the court should hold that the promissory estoppel claim is subject to a preponderance of the evidence standard. And I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Hey, counsel, even if we agreed with you that the jury instruction on promissory estoppel was an error, why is it not harmless error in view of the jury's verdict that there was no contract? And the contract claim, the essential element there was the same essential element as to promissory estoppel as to whether there was this oral promise to split the profits. And if the jury finds that there's no preponderance, why isn't that conclusive as to promissory estoppel?
I believe that came up in our reply brief, Your Honor. If I have a moment to think on that, and if I could answer that on rebuttal.
Okay. All right. You've got 5 minutes rebuttal. And any other further questions at this time, Judge Batchelder, Judge Scratch?
No, thank you.
You'll have your 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
From the appellees. Appellee.
May it please the court. My name is Adam Charnas, and I represent John Grassi and Alltech in this appeal. I'd like to start with the quasi-contract claims, unjust enrichment and quantum merit, and point out that the entire argument that Michael makes on appeal is completely different than the unjust enrichment quantum merit argument he made in the district court. Counsel explained that his current quantum merit unjust enrichment argument is for, quote, work performed before 2012. That argument was never made in the district court. It was never presented to the district court. In fact, if you look at Michael's brief in opposition to summary judgment, which is docket number 26, at page IDs 1453 to 1454, they focus entirely on a claim for quantum merit and unjust enrichment that arises after 2012 that relates to the Honda deal. And just to quote two sentences that run across those two pages. Plaintiffs have alleged that John Grassi gained control over the proceeds from the Honda project by promising Michael Grassi that he and CFOM would share in the proceeds of the project if they helped John Grassi and Alltech secure a long-term investment with Honda. After such agreement was secured, however, John Grassi denied he had made the promise to his twin brother. Such is the essence of a valid quasi-contractual claim. And then the next paragraph continues claiming that based on quasi-contract, they're entitled to the 35% of the proceeds for the Honda contract. So their entire argument below related to post-2012. The briefing in the district court included not a single...
Counselor, I think we understand your arguments on those. I wondered if I might direct you more to some of the summary judgment decisions made by the court below that frankly give me some concern. My understanding is that the court disregarded some evidence on the basis that it was just self-serving evidence. I'm struggling with that because my understanding of sworn statements, whether it's a deposition or an affidavit, is that that can state a dispute of material fact that prohibits summary judgment. And I believe our Harris versus J.B. Robinson Jewelers case in 2010 made clear that a court may not disregard evidence merely because it serves the interest of the party introducing it. Why was there not error in that determination by the court?
Well, two responses, Your Honor. First of all, the principle that a self-serving assertion of forgery without corroborating evidence is insufficient to overcome a summary judgment motion has not been disputed by Michael and CFOM in this case. Their briefs do not dispute that is a correct position of law. So I think any challenge to that has been waived. They didn't resist it in the district court either. Go on and give me your more fundamentally,
then we can talk about this because I have concerns about that answer.
Sure. More fundamentally, there's wide agreement among the courts that forgery is different because it's very easy to come in the face of a contract or a signed lease or some other document and say, that's not my signature. And if that's all you need to say to overcome summary judgment motion and get to trial, the plaintiff can get to trial on a claim of forgery in every single case.
So here's the question based on that argument. Is that all that was presented by plaintiff?
It was, Your Honor.
A blanket, bland denial that it was my signature.
Well, we think it was. And what counsel said a few minutes ago was that the only thing he pointed to was the fact that Michael filed the first salvo in this litigation and filed suit first. Well, that's not corroboration. That indicates that he wants to get some money and wants to litigate this. You know, fundamentally, for Michael's position, in his briefs, he relies on the fact that he allegedly told Mr. Rizzuti that the signature was forged. The problem with that argument is when he told Rizzuti. He told Rizzuti after the lawsuit was filed. You know, once the parties were in litigation, he said, that's not my signature. And you know, that's way too late to have any credibility or corroboration. Of course, at that point, after he had sued and after counterclaims had been filed, he was going to deny the veracity of the authenticity of the signature.
Well, what I'm struggling with is, I think we can all agree as a simple matter that a court does not have the capacity to judge the credibility of witnesses. Right? That's a matter for the jury.
That's right.
So I'm looking at some of the items that were barred from presentation at the trial based on this early decision of the court that the two IP exhibits, I think 24 and 27, were in fact valid and authentic documents. And the court made that decision in the face of a fair amount of evidence. I'm concerned about the judging of the credibility of that evidence. We have an affidavit in the record from the mother of the two brothers that said that my son told me at that time, John, at that time, that I had a 50-50 deal with my brother to share. We have the differences in the signature. The judge refused to allow the IP contracts to be placed into evidence, said, I've already decided that these are valid. And yet part of the plaintiff's argument was that I didn't sign that. Look at two different IP signature document separated by what, 3 days, signed with a different designation, a different signature, Mike versus Michael. It also includes, the decision by the court below that he must have had and signed these two IP agreements because the DynaPro agreement, he used that very document. I'm struggling with why the use of that document doesn't mean only that he had seen the document. He conceded he had seen it, and he said he refused to sign it. And then the one he used and signed, he signed differently from the two different signatures in the two IP agreements. Plus, he initialed every page of the document. And on the IP agreements, there's no initialing. So I'm just struggling with, I'm a little bit concerned that the court below has usurped the province of the jury by ignoring testimony, sworn testimony from the mother, differences in the documents, in order to draw a conclusion that really should have been entrusted to the jury. Why is that incorrect?
Well, Your Honor, let me take those in order and then maybe speak more broadly. The mother's testimony, I think, is with respect, is completely irrelevant. The mother testified that the brothers had a 50, she was told the brothers had a 50-50 arrangement. That statement to her happened several years before the IP agreements were signed. And it had the financial arrangement, if any, between the brothers is completely irrelevant to whether the IP agreements were signed or not. The IP agreements themselves had no financial.
If the core dispute is you and I had a deal and your client told his mother that there was a deal and now denies that there was ever any discussion of a deal and that only governing documents are the IP agreements.
Your Honor, I would concede, and the trial and the district court accepted the fact that the mother's testimony in that regard was relevant to the question about whether there was an oral agreement to divide the proceeds 65-35. It's relevant to that. What I'm suggesting is it's completely irrelevant to whether Michael signed the IP agreements or not. Let me also point out, Your Honor, that there's a third agreement which he says also was forged, which a witness testified at summary judgment by affidavit that she witnessed him signing, that she then notarized because she's a public notary. And under the federal rules of evidence, that is evidence of authenticity of the signature. Yet he says, no, I didn't sign that either.
Well, let me ask you about her testimony. That's Hawker you're referring to?
Yes, Your Honor.
Hawker testified that she was the only witness to Michael Grassi's signature. And John Grassi initially testified that he did not witness it, but later testified that, in fact, he did witness it, in contra to Hawker's testimony. So isn't there conflicting testimony from the presentation of John Grassi's claims about who identified who was present at the signature on that document?
Well, there is a difference in recollection as to whether John was present or not, but Ms. Hawker is clear that she witnessed him signing it and that she says she would not have notarized it if she did not witness him signing it. And under the federal rules of evidence, that is conclusive evidence of authenticity. You know, the other point I would like to make, Your Honor,
is it conclusive or is it a rebuttable presumption?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. It is evidence that is sufficient to establish authenticity. Michael could have come in with other evidence to rebut it, which he didn't. It would have been very...
Is that an Ohio rule that you have to have other evidence if you allege a forgery?
It is not. We fight... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I mean, where does it come from? I mean, is there Ohio case that says that, or where does that come
from? We cite cases from a wide variety of district courts and courts of appeals in our brief. It's as far as we're aware, it's a general principle of law that both state and federal courts have applied. My understanding,
is it the rule of evidence? I mean, I don't see it in the rules of evidence. And if it's an Ohio rule or a case law, I think you ought to have some Ohio cases to it. I don't recall it in Michigan.
No, I don't think.
I mean, my practice was limited in Michigan, and I was first of all surprised that John did not testify that yes, this is Michael's signature. I know my twin brother. I've worked with him for years. It's his signature because I know his signature. We don't have that, and we don't have any expert handwriting testimony one way or the other, which you would think that you would have it here. It's such an important issue, but there's not an expert either way. And that this is a matter of summary judgment when there does appear to be an issue of fact, a dispute of fact anyway, that I'm not sure that this is a matter that should not have gone to the jury either.
Well, let me respond with respect to the doctrine this way. First of all, this court has said in a number of cases, most recently we cite in our brief in the Mascara case, which is 745 Federal Appendix 568, that an unsubstantiated self-serving assertion will not preclude an adequately supported motion for summary judgment from being granted. I'm not aware of this court addressing the forgery issue, but at page 28.
Just because something is helps your interest and it helps your own case, that doesn't make it inadmissible. It may lessen its weight, but it something that helps your case, even if it comes from your own testimony, that it normally is admissible. At least that's my understanding.
I agree with that as a general proposition.
So anyway, that whatever statement you wrote, you read there, I'm not sure I agree with it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, whatever statement you read, you read from federal appendix, I mean, an unpublished opinion that's not even binding on this, but I'm not even sure I agree with it, that's all.
Well, we also, more particularly on the forgery question, at page 28, note 8, we cite cases, and this is just a sampling of cases, of course, from New York, Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, from the Third Circuit, Eastern District of New York, Western District of Missouri, and state court in a state of intermediate appellate court in New Jersey, all applying the forgery rule.
We're dealing with Ohio law, right?
Well, I think this is a rule, go back to the point you made a moment ago, I think this is a rule of procedure, not a rule of substantive Ohio law about what, in other words, I think federal law governs what is required to overcome a summary judgment motion that's filed in federal court. So and certainly federal rules of evidence would apply, not Ohio rules of evidence.
Sure, I don't see anything in the federal rules of evidence that require supporting evidence when you claim a forgery, that's all.
Let me ask one more question, because in attempted to put in at trial and in the record in this case, is our trial exhibit 8, that is an unredacted email chain of Alitec employees that the plaintiff argues shows that indicates or leaves the impression among Alitec employees that Michael Grassi had not signed the IP agreements as of March 5, 13. Now, I'm struggling with the fact that that is, to me, evidence by the other party that the plaintiff is using to support his claim, that the court then goes on and decides as a court without recognizing that there's a dispute of material fact about those emails that comes from Alitec employees. How can that not be a jury question?
Well, it might be a jury question, except for the fact that Michael had Exhibit 8 before summary judgment. He did not submit it in support of summary judgment. And he tried to submit it in opposition to a motion in limine. And the district court said, you had this document, you didn't submit it, You haven't explained why you didn't submit it, and therefore I'm not going to consider it. And at trial, after trial, when the issue came again, she said the same thing. She said, this is the second time, the district court said, this is the second time you're submitting this document that you had from the very beginning. You've never explained why you didn't submit it before, and I'm not going to allow it. It was an error for me not to allow it at trial for that reason. Okay, I think that's the point, Your Honor. If
counsel, you're out of time. If you want to just wrap it up, you want to wrap up your argument?
I think I've said what I'm going to say. Happy to answer
any questions. Any further questions, Judge Batchelder, Judge Scranch?
No.
No? Okay. All right. We've got 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Griffin. May it please the court. Judge Griffin, the answer to the question you asked me after my main presentation about the whether the
jury verdict on contract really holds harmless the jury instruction on promissory estoppel. Right. Tell me why it doesn't.
The answer to that is on page 21 of my reply brief. I give two reasons why that would not be so. And I think the better answer is that the jury could have believed the existence of the 50-50 promise back in 2008-2009, even if the jury disbelieved the 65-35 promise in 2012.
Okay, so the jury was only doing the 2012 promise? That was their only, the verdict was only on that promise?
Mr. Charnas can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think there was any jury interrogatories. I think it was just a general verdict on the contract claim. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's the situation.
Okay, so why doesn't the jury verdict affect both promises? You said 2012 and 2000, whatever the other date was.
Yeah. That's a good question, Your Honor. I've not thought about it that way. I think that we would have to go look at the jury instructions on that claim, which I'm not in a position to do at this second. And I'd be happy to brief that if the court wishes.
No, if you say it's in your reply brief, I'll read your reply brief again. So, all right.
And I do think the answer to that would come down to what the jury was instructed on specifically on those claims.
Okay.
Can you respond, counselor, to the concern that that the judge decided matters that are entrusted, matters of credibility and weight of the evidence in making summary judgment on disputed facts when those issues should have gone to the jury?
Well, that is our position, Your Honor. I think that the issue of, I take it Your Honor is asking specifically about the intellectual property claims as opposed to the quantum merit unjust enrichment claim?
Yes. I'm more interested in I'm not as interested in the quantum merit and unjust enrichment. I'm more concerned about this determination by the court that these IP documents were authentic and then used to bar the entrance of evidence on the whole subject was taken away from the jury.
Right. I think the key point there, Your Honor, is that on summary judgment, the district court was deciding the IP claims, not the contract.
So the question is, was that within the district court's capacity, or were there disputed issues of material fact that relate and issues of credibility and weight of the evidence that should have taken that claim to the jury?
And the answer is yes, because of Michael's deposition testimony that the signature on the IP agreements was invalid. And then at trial, we had all this other corroborating evidence in addition to that, right, that should have been the basis for allowing all of Michael's evidence in at trial. And instead, so we have two different bodies of evidence, which is part of the complicating factor in this case. We had a body of evidence on summary judgment and a body of evidence before the trial court on different sets of claims. But even on the summary judgment claim on the IP claims, the trial judge should have accepted Michael's testimony that wasn't his signature and all the other corroborating circumstances and said there's a genuine issue of material fact here. And the district court just compounded the problem by relying on the law of the case doctrine to say, once I've decided the IP claims on summary judgment, I'm not going to revisit any evidentiary issue, even though I'm now looking at different claims that are going to go to the jury. And that's all I have, Your Honors.
All right. I do see that this case was referred to the mediation office early on. Would there be any value in sending it back to the mediation office at this point?
Mr. Charnas?
Your Honor, I on the one hand, I never say never to mediate. I have to check with my client. I didn't participate in previous settlement discussions, so maybe counsel and I could chat with our clients and then chat with each other after argument and then let the clerk's office know.
That would be wonderful. Okay.
I would add to that, if ever there was a sad case that ought to be resolved, this one seems to be it. Because both of the parties here, one of them walks off with a considerable amount of money, the other one none, but neither of them walks off with his twin. And that's sad. If there's a way to resolve this case through mediation, I would urge both parties to think about it.
I would join that also, because you can have a hand in how a case is resolved and avoid the possibility of retrial and put this thing behind the family.
All right. Very good. All right. Case will be submitted. Thank you for your arguments, counsel. You may call the next case.